it's the first time really that this kind of domestic, you know, kind of party meeting will have a real global message.
China prepares for the 19th Communist Party Congress. It's Tuesday, October 17th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, inside North Korea's rapidly developing missile technology, the risk of possible military confrontation with North Korea, an eclectic mix of Bollywood music comes to Washington, a royal butler combating sleep deprivation. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Chinese President Xi Jinping will preside over the 19th Communist Party Congress, a significant every five-year political event, which is expected to open later Wednesday in Beijing. The Congress, expected to last about a week, will unveil the country's leaders and offer a blueprint for national development for the next 5 years. President Xi is expected to keep his post as General Secretary. The state-run China Daily said the nearly 2,300 delegates will approve guidelines for this country's two goals: completing a moderately prosperous society by the year 2020 and becoming a modern socialist country that is prosperous, strong, democratic, culturally advanced, and harmonious by the middle of the century. Carrie Brown is an associate fellow of the Asia program at London's Chatham House and professor of Chinese studies and director of the Lao China Institute at King's College. He explained to VOA's Victor Beatty the importance of this week's meeting.
Firstly, it marks a likely consolidation of Xi Jinping's powers, the current party secretary and sort of president of the country. And so we're likely to see some information about, you know, the people that he wants around him to take the country into the next 5 years. And I think the second reason is that this is a genuinely global Congress because, as never before, China is a very dominant and prominent power in all sorts of areas, from climate change to the economy. And it's the first time really that this kind of domestic, you know, kind of party meeting will have a real global message and global importance. So that means that it's significant in ways that its previous ones 5 years ago and beyond weren't.
Is this typically a time when China changes leaders?
Yes, this is not going to be a wholesale change. So Xi Jinping is like, well, he almost definitely will stay on as the party secretary, and his premier, Li Keqiang, is most likely to stay in place. But of the current seven members of the standing committee, that's the sort of absolute pinnacle of power in China, five are likely to retire. So we are likely to see five new faces. I say likely because historically the Politburo has gone down to five members and it's gone up to nine members. So it is possible, but unlikely, that there will be an increase or a decrease. But almost certainly there's going to be a turnover.
Will these be handpicked people by Xi Jinping or by others?
So the process is through consultation, we're told, and it goes right from the grassroots right up to the Central Congress of 3,000 members. The idea is that there's a sort of appraisal of leaders from provinces and elsewhere, and the ones that have achieved the best in terms of growth, stability, and all the other measurements are the ones that are put forward. So it is a meritocratic system, but in fact, we know that at the end of the day, the input of a leader like Xi Jinping is going to be absolutely crucial because he's the one that's going to be working with these people, so he has the final say whether they get in or not.
Kerry, when we think of Chinese leaders, we think, of course, Mao Zedong and the reformist former leader Deng Xiaoping. Where does Xi Jinping line up among Chinese leaders?
He's similar to them because he's a great nationalist. He believes in national Chinese glory and the sort of, you know, renaissance of the great Chinese nation. He is different to Mao Zedong because he's nowhere near as autocratic, although people say he is. The China of today is not the China of 50 years ago. It's much more complex, and he couldn't be that kind of autocratic, all-powerful leader. But he's a charismatic leader in the way that Mao Zedong was. And in terms of Deng Xiaoping, well, the framework that China operates in today, of the market with socialist characteristics, as they call it, is still in place, and that was put there by Deng Xiaoping. So you could say that he's a successor of Deng. He's not a sea-change leader in the way that Deng Xiaoping was.
What do you see as far as domestic as well as foreign policy achievements?
So in the domestic space, the Communist Party has become much more disciplined. It has become a bit more predictable. It's more rules-based now. And the anti-corruption struggle has meant that officials are pushed out of areas of the business or, you know, the economy that they shouldn't be active in. So it's really a political party. And there's been a lot of policy announcements, but really not a lot of implementation. It's a work in progress. In terms of international, I think the achievements are bigger. So signing of the Paris Accord, a meeting with the Taiwanese ex-president Ma Ying-jeou in 2015, and then a whole raft of kind of other initiatives, from the Belt Road Initiative to the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. Xi Jinping has almost certainly been a highly activist foreign policy player.
Kerry Brown said he'll be watching to see if President Xi Jinping intends to be an autocratic ruler who is selected to sit in the Politburo. He said a key issue will be the relationship of the economic market to the state. He also believes China has been growing wary of Pyongyang's growing nuclear and missile threat, and with a change in leadership less sympathetic to the North, could bring greater political and economic pressure on its neighbor. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. China Party Congress expected to signal next 5 years of maritime policy. Boat carrying Rohingya Muslims capsizes, drowning 6 children. Tense U.S.-North Korea standoff slowly escalates. Lawyers of jailed South Korean president resign. Four-way Afghan peace talks set to resume in Oman. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. The rapid expansion of North Korea's missile technology has puzzled many around the world. VOA's George Pudich explains how a country whose citizens are often on the brink of starvation develops technology for building sophisticated systems like ballistic missiles.
This propaganda video produced by North Korea's state-controlled media shows rows upon rows of machines churning out parts for ballistic rockets and other weaponry. North Korean defectors, with knowledge of their factories, say the machines are running on the time-proven concept of computer numerical control, or CNC.
CNC is like the mother technology to manufacturing long-range missiles and nuclear facilities for North Korea. It is especially crucial for the country because only with CNC it can make the tens of thousands of missile components and thousands of complex and precision elements going into nuclear test devices.
Since metal printing is still not widely available, many factories around the world rely on what's called subtractive manufacturing. That's a process where parts are manufactured by cutting into a solid piece of metal. In CNC technology developed around mid-20th century, this process is controlled by computers. It creates a lot of waste, but machines are fully automated and enclosed in cabinets.
North Korea has a CNC technology that enables them to produce missile parts by themselves. So the current sanctions, which block North Korea from receiving missile components, cannot stop them developing and testing missiles. They are ineffectual and meaningless.
Experts say over the years North Korea has perfected not only the CNC technology, but also a method called reverse engineering, by which imports of sophisticated parts are disassembled and faithfully copied, disregarding copyright infringements. It's estimated that North Korea has 15,000 CNC machines. They have almost hero-like status and are often featured in television footage together with the supreme leader. George Pudich, VOA News, Washington.
Stay with VOA Asia as we look at the growing threat of military conflict with North Korea as a result of its developing technology. Happening now in Asia, flooding and landslides have hit parts of Vietnam as a typhoon is making landfall in the northern portion of the country. The government said it was fixing dikes, dams, and roads damaged by last week's floods that killed 72 and collapsed 200 houses. It has also warned ships and boats to avoid the typhoon. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're very happy, as always, that you're with us today on VOA Asia. On Sunday, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said diplomatic efforts to persuade the Kim Jong-un government to give up its nuclear and long-range ballistic missile program will continue, quote, until the first bomb drops. But as the tense nuclear standoff between North Korea and the United States continues to escalate, VOA's Brian Padden reports from Seoul that the risk of military conflict grows while hopes for a peaceful solution remain remote.
President Donald Trump's pessimism on the prospect of finding any diplomatic solution to the North Korean nuclear threat may be just a negotiating tactic.
I think I might have a somewhat different attitude and a different way than other people. I think perhaps I feel stronger and tougher on that subject than other people.
But it could also be laying the groundwork for the eventual use of military force to stop North Korea from developing a nuclear-armed intercontinental ballistic missile.
This administration, not just Trump, the administration is systematically preparing for a time not that far off in the future. It's basically next year, the way I interpret it in context, when diplomacy has failed.
A recent poll shows increasing U.S. support among Trump's Republican supporters for a preemptive strike to take out North Korean nuclear or ballistic missile sites, but a strong majority of Americans still oppose such a move. While launching such a strike to prevent an imminent North Korean attack on the U.S. would be a justifiable use of force, it might be difficult to prove. Any first strike military options, including possible cyber attacks to sabotage North Korean missile tests, or a decapitation strike to kill Kim Jong-un and the leadership in Pyongyang, would risk deadly retaliation against South Korea and the 28,000 American troops stationed in the South, and could plunge the entire region into a nuclear war.
I think that would be morally, diplomatically, strategically, politically, a great disaster, not only for the people of Korea and the region, but also for the United States of America, too.
North Korea says the Trump administration's hostile intent and the increased joint military drills with South Korea happening this week further justify its need for a nuclear deterrent. North Korea, in turn, is expected to test another long-range missile soon. Neither side is acting to reduce tensions as they remain locked in what seems a deadly game of brinksmanship. Brian Padden, VOA News, Seoul.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia, at least 10 people drowned after a boat carrying 50 Rohingya fleeing Myanmar sank on its way to Bangladesh, adding to nearly 200 previous drownings in the Naf River. Officials say 21 people survived the incident. This story and more can be seen online at VOA 60. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, you've likely heard of the Smithsonian Institution here in Washington. It's a series of many different museums located in the center of the city. Washington tourists and residents alike can now again visit the very popular Freer Sackler Museum Galleries. They've reopened following 18 months of renovation and are the Smithsonian's Museums of Asian Arts. The kickoff of the events included the Illuminasia Festival, which transformed the museum's grounds with an Asian food market, interactive cooking, art demonstrations, and live music. VOA Asia's Skylar Ogden visited with our intern. She's here to tell us more.
Illuminasia was a great festival. It really brought the colors, sounds, and arts of Asia to Washington, D.C. And I got a chance to speak to one of the musicians who performed for the band Red Bharat. Their sound is this really kind of eclectic mix of Bollywood music, Punjab folk music, also jazz, rock, hip-hop. And it's also rooted in the brass bands of India. And it's this really kind of crazy mix of anything and everything. If you haven't heard it before, here's a clip of one of their songs.
Thank you.
Sonny was a really approachable guy. He was very engaged in his music and his sense of purpose. I asked him what Red Barat means and what inspired his music. This is what he had to say.
Barat is a procession that happens during wedding time, and it happens from a groom side to a bride side. It involves the brass band playing, the Indian brass band tradition. It involves singing and dancing. It's just a huge, joyous, like, explosion, celebration before an actual wedding begins. It's literally the groom side of the family going to the bride side of the family to bring her and the family to the wedding ceremony, to the mandap. So Red Barat stems from that because of my introduction to Indian brass bands when I was 5 and my love for the Indian brass band culture and the sound and just the vibe of it all. And then red, it's basically my favorite color, but has the connotations of love, excitement, of revolution, rebellion. It's a popular color worn at weddings, and it sounded better than Blue Barat. Funny enough, no one in my family is in the entertainment industry whatsoever, but I think at home, because I come from a devotional background, Jainism religion, that I was always having bhajans, devotional songs, played at home, and my parents led the Jain Society of Rochester, kind of started it there in the 70s, so I was very, very much part of that community. So I just grew up with song and bhajans at home. I grew up with different types of music, never felt at home just, you know, playing Indian music, never felt at home just playing prog rock, never felt at home just playing jazz. I loved it all and was always trying to find my voice and my identity through music. So that idea of multiplicity and multiple identities was a way to find itself through music. I think what I love about playing music is, you know, just picking up your instrument, there's something natural, it's this extension and connection to producing sound and trying to get to some perfect place of producing sound and concentrating on what that sound is. And then performing, though, in front of people is a whole different thing because you have that energy and that connection. And performing with other musicians, the self disappears and everything becomes one organism with the people you're playing with and then also the people that are there. It's always a different thing when you're practicing in a rehearsal room versus then being out in front of everyone and playing and connecting to those energies. And there's just something magical about it, and I think that's what I love about it.
You can hear and see more of Sonny Jain and Red Barat on our Facebook page at VOA Asia. We thank our interns and Skylar Ogden for bringing the story to us. This news alert from VOA Asia, the Seoul International Aerospace and Defense Exhibition, is showcasing a lineup of warplanes in a joint exercise of force with the United States against North Korea and its growing threats. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA 60 and VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. Imagine having a butler to keep you home, or your home rather, in perfect order. Well, you don't have to be a blue blood anymore to get that kind of service. As VOA's Olga Loganova tells us, a British butler with royal references is available for hire.
30 years ago, Chris Ely would not have imagined that his centuries-old profession would take him to this Bronxville, New York.
Good afternoon. Mr. Ely, how are you? Nice to meet you. Thank you for coming to my house.
What you're looking for is symmetry. You would want all of these to be roughly an inch. I know that my thumb is an inch.
When Chris Ely turned 18, he became a footman to Her Majesty the Queen of England. After 2 months of training, he was tasked with cleaning and caring for clothes, participating in ceremonial duties, and remembering all the nooks and crannies of the basement of Buckingham Palace. He saw all the glamour of the royal family up close and personal, even riding in a carriage with Princess Diana.
Part of what we did was mundane, like moving mail around from the private secretaries to waiting at table, and we did ceremonial duties. I rode around on a lot of carriages. It was a wonderful opportunity to go and work in a place that was sort of mythical.
Among his other employers were film director Joel Schumacher, Elton John's manager John Reed, New York socialite Brooke Astor, as well as diplomat Saudi sheikhs and Russian oligarchs.
Sometimes people have more stuff than they'd ever admit to, but they don't like to think that they have servants. It's a very American thing. It's sort of, they're almost embarrassed to have servants.
Christopher Ely has traveled the world running people's homes and lives. Today he's his own boss, but his company follows time-honored traditions.
You'd put the water here. If you're doing red wine, the red wine glass would go here. If you're doing champagne, you'd put it at the back.
What we do as an architect, as a designer, there's a science behind it that not necessarily people know. And what he does, it's so meticulously perfect that when you do it to perfection, when you make everything perfect, the final result is just totally different.
Chris Ely says you don't need a big staff to run a proper home. After all, he does his own laundry and teaches others to follow suit.
And we match that with that side.
See, that's the secret.
Practice makes perfect, but Chris Ely knows that no sheet can compare to those at Buckingham Palace. There, the sheets are still washed by hand. Olga Loginova and Sergei Gusev, VOA News, Bronxville, New York.
It is estimated that nearly 40 million people in the United States alone suffer from chronic sleep deprivation. But VOA's Kevin Enix has stayed up to tell us about a new study, perhaps the first of its kind, which is shedding light on how and why humans sleep or don't sleep.
Canadian researchers studying sleep patterns chose the Hadza people in Tanzania because their environment is much the same as the one humans lived in a million years ago.
They're in one of the least light pollution status areas on the planet. In the West, 99% of every individual that lives in a post-industrial context is exposed to light pollution. So the Hadza are exposed to almost no light pollution at all.
Researcher David Sampson also says they live the same way as our ancestors did.
They are a group that uses foraging to survive. So they're hunter-gatherers. They're using the same subsistence strategy that our ancestors used in the same ecology for 1.8 million years. So they were really the perfect group to answer these questions with.
What Sampson and his team discovered is that the Hadza sleep at all kinds of times, not just at night.
We found something quite surprising, in fact. We found that their sleep was incredibly asynchronous. So by this I mean that it was very, very rare that any of the individuals were asleep all at the same time.
But why? The answer may be that life back then was really dangerous, and it made sense for somebody to always be on watch. By contrast, young people in advanced societies tend to stay up late and sleep late, while the elderly seem to go to sleep early and get up early.
As it turns out, this may have been an adaptive behavior, this short, fragmented sleep in elderly individuals and this shift to a more lark-like pattern. It may have been beneficial in an evolutionary context.
Sleep, it turns out, has never been a one-size-fits-all kind of a thing.
If there's one clinical jewel that we think emerges from this research, is that it normalizes variation in sleep patterns in humans. So we have this bias, this sort of propensity in the West to look at anything outside that bell curve that's non-normal and to label it or categorize it perhaps as a sleep disorder in this context. Mm.
And that much-needed afternoon nap may be a holdover from a time when staying awake at night meant everyone woke up alive. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Some of our listeners are in Thailand, listening via Chiang Mai University Radio, FM 100 in Chiang Mai University, Thailand. Thank you so much for joining us. Also, U Radio of Hat Yai University, FM 101.25 at Hat Yai University in Thailand. We thank everyone there and around the world who've been listening to us today. You can also write to us via Facebook at VOA Asia or send us an email at voaasia@voanews.com. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Daryl Smith, managing editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.